Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah Leduc. The critically acclaimed off-Broadway retelling of how Oz's Tin Man lost his heart features James Ortiz as the star, creator, puppet designer, co-director, and writer in this beautiful, imaginative theatrical experience by Strange Men & Company. The show is currently running at New World Stages in New York City, and James Ortiz joins us now to tell us more. James, welcome to the Roundtable.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So tell me first about Strange Men & Company, how it came together, what your mission statement is. Oh, no. Let's be more creative than that. Yeah. What you're doing.
Well, Strange Men & Company is a small company of mostly actors and designers and other strange people, other people from different artistic backgrounds. And we try to put things together and make things happen. And what we're working on right now is The Woodsman, which is an adaptation of the Tin Man's origins from the novel of The Wizard of Oz, told with puppetry and movement and solo violin and no text. And it's this really kind of fun, wacky thing that is definitely very, very what Strange Men is, I think.
How long have you been working on this project?
This is the fifth production we've done in 3 years. So that's a lot of productions to do in 3 years.
Yeah.
It was initially just a sketch, a doodle that we tacked on to a fundraising party that we were putting together for a different show we were working on. And I was like, well, that was great. That was a quick little 3 weeks of cranking something out and making some puppets and putting these things together. And really kind of tried it and made it work. And the response was so overwhelming and so moving to me that there was too many people around me that would have really hurt me if I didn't follow through with this show. So I was given the opportunity to try it out in different venues and keep revising it and keep revising it again, since it's a show with no text and it is primarily physical. That just sort of means that we don't have lines to depend on. So that just sort of means that what you're really working with at the end of the day is the actor's emotional life. And you end up sort of refining and going, actually, now you're sort of in a different play, or this, let's bring this over here, or more specifically, you know, we're endlessly tweaking, endlessly refining and going, is this the clearest type of storytelling we can be doing with the medium that we're playing in right now?
And does that clarity and the security that you're making the right decision come from the creative people, everybody working on it, and the audience input, or not really the audience as much?
It's definitely both. It's definitely both. I mean, I think we're all, the great thing about the group is that it's on stage, it's all actors, really. What's really exciting is the fact that so many of them are puppeteering or doing this sort of very stylized sort of, it's sort of out of the Lecoq method of physical theater and mime. They're all sort of actors, and none of them have been trained in either of those disciplines particularly. So what's exciting is that they're approaching it from an actor perspective. They're approaching it from a character perspective, or what does a character want, or, you know, not to get too, you know, Anne Bogart or anything. But so I think the fact that we're always going, that didn't play, that wasn't working as much, I actually don't know what you're communicating to me here in this moment. Normally that shouldn't work. It shouldn't work that it's such an open dialogue, and I can't, you know, I think other people could say better as to what and why it does work, but I think you just have a bunch of people that really, really care about this material. And I think at the end of the day, you can feel that on stage. And you can also, that is why I think we're sort of refining and always talking about it. The curtain falls, and then we're going, actually, you know. And it becomes this really interesting conversation.
And what kind of audience feedback do you get? How do you check in with them? Do you just feel the room, or have you had like talkbacks?
Oh my gosh, we've had a handful of, I mean, again, and the fifth production.
Right.
So we've had a handful of, you know, I sort of learned a while ago that this is a funny thing, but if people want to talk to you about your show after the show, it means that something's working. And so many people, you know, it was really a fascinating learning process for me of, I would just try to talk to as many people as I could in the early days of this show. And then it would become a thing of going, what are the common things I'm hearing? And what are the common sort of notes or thoughts? And, you know, it just became this thing of, well, this is now a universal conversation as opposed to sort of like what I think. But we have had a couple talkbacks this go around. We had one that was moderated by Cheryl Henson of the Jim Henson Foundation.
And that's amazing.
So cool.
Yeah.
I had met her once before, and I just am weak at the knee and can't talk to her. You know, started talking about her father's love for the Oz books, and I was like, I can't be here anymore. I'm going to die.
No, when I relate, I mean, I don't work in puppetry at all, but when I swear to something... Yeah. I swear to Jim Henson.
That is so interesting. I think there is something about the fact that he has been in everybody's childhood consciousness from a very young age. I think there's something really exciting about that.
What was the first puppet you ever designed?
Yikes. Okay. I mean, I've been involved in puppetry for a lot, most of my life. And I started off with marionettes. And I think one of the first marionettes I ever made was, humorously, a witch. And there's a witch. There's a witch character that plays a huge role in The Woodsman, and it's funny that, of course, this is what follows me. I mean, puppetry just was. You know, I was the quiet, introverted sort of art student, the clay and the paint and the, you know, leave me alone and let me make something. And I found my way towards theater, and then somewhere along the way, I found my way towards puppetry, and it just is this perfect blend of both those two things. You know, I've been saying two things about puppetry lately, and I think it's true: is that it is the CGI of theater. And I think there's some interesting, and I mean that in the positive sense. I think CGI can often be used as a dirty word, but I think there's something exciting about the possibility of it.
Right. And when people put CGI on stage, it's like, I feel like there was a more theatrical way to do this.
Exactly. It's a little something else.
Yeah.
There's something really exciting about puppetry and the fact that it is you, in some way, the audience is engaging with their own imaginations. I mean, the puppets that I tend to make and the type of puppetry that I'm attracted to is generally puppets that are not terrifically, they don't have a lot of controls for their face. They don't have a lot of animation in their face. So it is mask work in the sense that you are intuiting as an audience. You are imagining what they're feeling. We're doing a lot of stuff to guide you, but at the end of the day, you're believing in dolls again, you know, and there's something really sort of engaged and magical about that interaction that happens.
You have a long-standing fascination in Oz as well.
Yes. My mom would like to hear this. It was the first book that was ever read to me by my mother. So there's obviously a lot of emotional resonance there. It was just one of those things where I think I had seen the movie a handful of times as a child. And then my mother, being an English teacher, was like, well, let's read the book. And it's like, okay. And it became this really exciting thing. Every night, a new chapter. And I just remember the illustration. I particularly remember the edition that I had. And then it just became this thing of like, this is so not the movie. This is so not that. It was just an exciting, it felt like in the books, Baum talks about that Oz is a real place. You know, it's not a dream. It's not Alice in Wonderland. It's not, you know, she doesn't bump herself on the head. It's a real place you can get to if you know the way. So there was something really empowering about that like being in my backyard was Oz in a very specific way. It was a real place. There's something about childhood imagination that's, I feel, different than, that is not quite the same from the other sort of staples of children's literature. There's something inherently both quieter and introverted about the Oz stories. I mean, it's a hero's quest for people trying to get things that they don't think they possess to become a better people. And along the way, and by so doing that, they end up changing the world, which is sort of the staple of any fantasy story hero's quest. They change the world by being better people. And you go, oh, there's something there.
Is the Tin Woodsman your favorite? Or do you have one?
Yeah, I mean, there's the books are so rich, and there's so many exciting characters. The Tin Woodsman, for I think most people that read the first Oz book, he really haunts the novel. We hear about his story, which the Woodsman goes into the origins of how he became who he was, and he wasn't always made of metal, and it's a sort of a tragic Greek drama that kind of gets him to where he is. But there's something about the fact that pretty much every chapter ends with some reminder of his pain in some way, in a really sort of like, oh, geez, man, Baum. There's an amazing little moment at the end or beginning of one chapter where the Tin Woodsman, they're all walking down the Olympic Road together. They're all together at this point. And he steps on a bug. and he hears it crunch under his foot, and he just starts crying, and he starts, and his jaw rusts because he's crying so much, and there he's making gestures like "fix me." They oil him, and then they go, "What happened?" And he went, "I stepped on a bug." And they're like, "Well, it's okay. I mean, things like this happen." He's like, "No, no. What you don't understand, I don't have a heart. You people with hearts have something to guide you that'll keep you from doing wrong. But since I don't have one, I have to be extra careful, and I have to be extra sure that I never hurt anything again." And you just go, there's a story inside of that guy. And I think there's just something exciting about him. Yeah.
Tell me about the music in the show.
Well, since The World That Bomb was right, I mean, the first Oz book was published in 1900. He wrote it in 1899. The more I read, I read this incredible biography about L. Frank Baum, called The Real Wizard of Oz by Rebecca Loncrane. Incredible. She teaches at Oxford. It was the most, like, I was very emotional reading the book. It was a lot to take in. But in learning more about his life and learning that, I think like most artists, but it was so extraordinary to find this out about him, that so many things... He wrote the first Oz book when he was in his 40s. So, I mean, he was putting his life experience into these novels through guises of magic and mystery and adventure. I mean, he was born with a heart condition. He had a heart attack when he was 10. One of his uncles served in the Civil War and was an amputee. There's lots of sort of interesting things about where the wizard came from. I mean, there's lots of sort of interesting facts about his family, and one of them owned a hardware store, and one of Baum's first tasks in working at the hardware store was to create a window display, and he happened to make one out of metal parts and pieces and made a man that was holding a sign. There's a lot of sort of odd little anecdotes that are all sort of cute, but I think he had a really complicated and interesting life. He lived during one of the most
turbulent,
thank you, periods. I mean, we were in this mixture of like trying to go towards modern medicine, but still believing in magic genuinely. I mean, seances and spiritualism and suffragettes and all of these. And interesting that all the power in Oz comes from the women. I think, you know, his mother was a suffragette. Anyway, I can go on and on. But learning about him informed the show in so many ways, because it, in a lot of ways, the world that he's writing about in Munchkin Country feels like the ancestors, his ancestors, the settlers, the pioneers that traveled west, the people that believed in they would find a land of utopia but never quite did. So I took my cue to push it more towards, it's sort of an amalgam of references from the 1850s to, in America, 1850s to 1890s. So it's a solo fiddle, solo violinist. There's a bit of dialogue at the beginning just to sort of get you into the world, to set the scene, and then we drop out, and then the music sort of takes over. And I think what's exciting is that it was interesting. Someone talked to me about it the other day and said the whole thing felt like a long poem. And I went, that's interesting. I haven't thought of it that way, but I don't think that's not right. Somebody else talked to me about it being like Edgar Allan Poe, like a romantic poem of Poe. And I went, that's interesting. Because there's no dialogue and because the music's so powerful, it is an emotional journey, and I think it creates more space for you to interpret, which I think is the best part. So the dialogue after the show, as we were talking about, is actually always the most exciting part. I went, I didn't intend that. That's great.
Speaking of window displays,
please.
You got to do one at a bookstore, one. How did that happen?
Well, Books of Wonder are the current publishers of the Oz series. I mean, they are in public domain right now, but they painstakingly create exact facsimiles to the novels as they would have appeared in the 1900s. Incredible bookstore. I mean, if anybody's been to Books of Wonder, it is like the childhood bookstore you wish you went to when you were a kid. And like it's Mr. Magorium's Wonder Emporium. It's just so glorious. And since they were the publishers, we kind of knocked on their door and asked around, and one thing led to another, and they were excited to help promote the show, and I got an opportunity, like Baum, to create a Woodsman window display where I got to finally sort of talk to the publishers of these books and other intense Oz fans that you know, I didn't try to engage too much in like Oz trivia, because I was like, I'm very confident in what I know, but I know that's not my territory. So I got to create this wonderful window display, and we got to sort of create the show inside of a 10 by 3 weird space. And I got to display their books. And what was really exciting is I just got to sort of pay it forward. You know, I made the show for my passion for these novels and for these stories that I think are saying something important about life. And I got to pay it forward in that way. It was really a very thrilling few days of me just in that tiny hot room making these sort of odd things for that space.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much. It's been super fun.
Strange Men and Company's The Woodsman is currently running at New World Stages in New York City. Links to more information are posted along with this interview at wamc.org/roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke, and you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.